was almost 4 centuries ago, when they appeared to be here along with Omanis to help the local people of Mombasa to get rid of the oppression of the Portuguese who were here for some decades. Therefore, it was almost 1662 that the Iranian visited this part of the world and helped the local people in overcoming the operations from the big powers at that time. And the second, in fact, migration from the Iranian was in 1820, which again the Baluchi from Iran migrated here, and they helped a lot in developing the coastal area of Kenya.
Thank you very much for that insight. Now, Ambassador Joshua Gatimu, what is the importance of the economic and trade ties between the two countries, and where are we moving to right now?
Thank you, Barak. I think as we have heard from my colleague in Kenya, trade relations between the two countries started a long time ago.
Yeah.
With the Iranians, at that time called Persians, yeah. Oman Arabs, coming to our coastal towns,
yeah.
For business. Mm-hmm. So it's something that has been going on mm-hmm. for a long time. And as years passed on,
yeah.
We have continued with the same trade between the two countries.
Yeah.
And most of the commodities traded in, for example, from our country,
yeah.
you find that we have tea ranks among the most important one.
Yeah.
Then coffee, and of late I think there is special liking for coffee
yeah.
in Iran amongst the youth, and we are noting that. And also horticultural products to this country. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think it is good to emphasize that though it has been minimal
yeah.
For some years because of sanctions
yeah.
on Iran, which we hope they will come to an end quite soon,
yeah.
we are still determined to continue with the trade between the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
And from here, I can tell you we have yeah. been getting a lot of petroleum products from Iran.
Yeah.
And I can also say that we have many Iranian business people in Kenya.
Okay.
With doing big mm-hmm. business. So mm-hmm. we are connected economically with Iran.
Now, back to you, Ambassador Barmaki. Now, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, what are some of the milestones which have been achieved in the Kenya-Iran ties?
If I want to refer to the milestones in the relations, I can refer to the visit of the high levels at the presidential level between two countries that helped a lot in expanding the relations, not only at the presidential level, but also at the ministerial and the vice president level. This is one part which is mostly political, but I can refer to one of the activities of our embassy here in Nairobi that refers to 1 year back, which is establishing and putting up the Iran House of Innovation and Technology mm-hmm. in Nairobi,
mm-hmm.
which is a very good help to the startups and on those companies who are knowledge-based in,
yeah.
in Kenya and in Iran. That House of Innovation and Technology mm-hmm. is of the Iranian knowledge. They are ready to present technologies to the Kenyan market. This house, which we call Aviation IH, ready to, and at the moment is doing the Kenyan startups in come up with new ideas to commercialize and also finance to send it to the market. These are in political and in economic aspects that I can refer to.
Mm-hmm.
between two countries. But we are still looking for lots of activities to do, and I hope in coming year I can have good news for you in expanding the relations between two countries that you can consider as milestones in the relations.
Thank you very much for that. Now, Ambassador Getimu, here in Tehran, since you arrived and started your mission, what steps have you taken to, you know, boost the trade and economic ties between Kenya and Iran?
Thank you, Mubarak, for that question. And since my arrival here, almost 1 year ago now, I think in April 13th, I will be 1 year in Tehran.
Oh, wonderful.
And since my arrival here, there have been delegations and delegations from Nairobi of business people. Mm-hmm. Thanks to my colleague in Nairobi for the support. Mm-hmm. They have been coming here to look for business opportunities. And I can tell you, during this period, we have had two very important meetings, two in Nairobi, for example, last year.
Yeah.
And another one recently in Naivasha, whereby we had a virtual meeting with the people, business people from Iran, some attending the meeting.
Yeah.
And really, Kenyans are anxious. They are ready to go to explore what they can get from here and what they can bring to this part of the world.
Oh, so we look forward to a great future
in
terms of trade.
We look forward to a great interaction as far as business and other activities are concerned.
Now, Ambassador Barmaki, away from business and economic issues, now, what are some of the humanitarian projects and development projects Iran is implementing in Kenya?
If I go back to the records, I can tell you that most of the these developmental and humanitarian assistance to Kenya was belonging before 2015. That according to the records, there were several projects in different parts of the country, which amounted to more than $5 million that we financed different projects for different parts, especially the remote areas on different issues like on water, sanitations, on building schools, and some other matters that were very necessary for that part of the country.
Now, we'll take a short break, viewers, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on the Kenya-Iran ties. Stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. We have a special program today on the diplomatic ties between Kenya and Iran, which are marking 50 years since their inception. Now, in the studio here, we have Ambassador Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran, and also joining us by a video link from Kenya is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Now, Ambassador Gatimu, as you mentioned earlier, it's almost 1 year since you arrived in Iran. Can you tell us how did you find the country, and what has been your experience over the last few months here?
Thank you, Mubarak, and I will be very honest in this one. Apart from what I was read in history a long time ago about the Persian Gulf, you know, the conquerors and so forth. Before I came here, the information about Iran is out there normally is not the correct one. So I remember some people would ask us, and my family and my spouse when we were coming. You people aren't you afraid of that place? Because the people think that Iran, especially Tehran, is very insecure. Because of the propaganda.
The propaganda, Western media propaganda,
But when we arrived here and looked around, the streets and everything, to me it looked like any other street in Europe.
Oh, great.
Those old streets, you know, with the carburetor, the tires and so forth. And very civilized people. People looking, who look like, in fact, Western people from the Western world. So, my earlier
perception
changed. And I've come to find out that the Iranians are very good with people, very kind, and they are working.
Oh, great to know that.
Maybe in our country, because we are also hard working, maybe we borrow some few traits from these parts of the world. So it's a country to be in, and with a long history, because they have a long history. There is a lot we can learn from from this country in matters of technology, for example. New methods, even you know, we are an agricultural state country. We can learn a lot about agriculture from here. And as I said about business and so forth, it's really a country we that I really intend to build up the relations for the betterment of the people of the two countries.
Thank you. Now, Ambassador Barmaki, as you noted earlier, the historical ties between Kenya and Iran, or actually Iran and the whole of East Africa, have been there for hundreds of years. Now, what is being done to sustain these people-to-people relations between the two nations?
If I look at the activities of the embassy we have done in different areas, with especially in last 1 year, I can tell you that the coordination between two embassies, I mean the Kenyan embassy in Tehran and the Iranian embassy, they had very good relations that rarely can find in the previous relations between two embassies. And we were very successful in supporting each other. As His Excellency Gatimu referred to, it was for the first time in our relation that in last 1 year, we had 11 delegations exchanged between two countries.
Ambassador Barmaki, our last question to you. Now, recently, there was a United Nations Environment Assembly held in Nairobi, and which voted to end plastic pollution. Can you tell us about the assembly and Iran's participation in this important global summit?
Thank you, Mubarak. Let me give some introduction on what I do here beside ambassadorial level to Kenya and bilateral. I am also the permanent representative of Iran to United Nations office in Nairobi. Maybe the audience doesn't know that we have two specialized agencies of the United Nations here which called United Nations Environment Program and United Nations Human Settlement.
Yeah.
These two are headquarters are in Nairobi, and the only headquarters of United Nations in a developing country. And this is why Kenya is also very important, Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
In that area, this year we had the United Nations Environment Assembly, the fifth session here, which held every 2 years. And one of the important resolution which has been adopted was on plastic pollution. And Iran was the co-sponsor, along with the other countries, mm-hmm. on this resolution. We succeeded to adopt this resolution in UNIA, and it is going to be to put up an international negotiating committee in 2022 to start preparing a text as a new multilateral environmental agreement on plastic pollution, the whole life of plastic production, from designing to disposal. And it is very important, and although it is very difficult, but we hope that by 2024 we are in a situation to conclude and to adopt the text as a new MEA. And Iran also has been elected from the regional group, Asia regional group, as the vice president to next session of UNIA, and that can help a lot in conducting the negotiation on plastic pollution resolution, which is going to be in next 2 years. Therefore, Iran can play a good role in that, because we have the same position as the vice president for next 2 years in the Bureau of UNIA 6, United Nations Environment Assembly 6.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Jafar Barmaki, for your time. It's been really great having you. And we hope to have more such conversations in future on the ties between these two great nations.
Can I add something, Mubarak, if
yeah.
You have time?
Yeah.
As I mentioned, I am in Mombasa now. I'm here to open the Balochistan Museum, one of the embassy activity in the 50th anniversary of the diplomatic relations between two countries.
Yeah.
In this day afternoon, we are going to open Baluchi Museum, which has been put up in very close collaboration with the Baluchi community in Mombasa and the Iranian embassy in Nairobi. And I hope that I can send you some short video clips from the opening, so you can add to your program.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Your Excellency. Yeah, Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, before we wind up, now, where do you see the Iran-Kenya ties in the next 4 years before the end of your mission?
To be frank, Mubarak, I expect to see more interaction between the political leadership at the top, the business people between the two countries, and ordinary Kenyans. Those are my expectations.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency, Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, for your time and for accepting our invitation.
Thank you very much, Mubarak.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
in the limelight.
What did Justice Clarence Thomas know, and when did he know it? The question usually gets directed at politicians, not judges. But it is a fair one in the light of the revelation on Thursday, 24th of March, that Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, was working feverishly behind the scenes and to a far greater degree than she previously admitted in a high-level effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist, Jesse Wegman. Jesse Wegman is a member of the editorial board of the newspaper. The piece is titled, Ginny and Clarence Thomas Have Done Enough Damage. What did Justice Clarence Thomas know, and when did he know it? The question usually gets directed at politicians, not judges. But it's a fair one in the light of the revelation on Thursday, 24th of March, that Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, was working feverishly behind the scenes and to a far greater degree than she previously admitted in a high-level effort to overturn the 2020 U.S. presidential election. As the Washington Post and CBS News first reported, Ms. Thomas, a supremely well-connected right-wing agitator, was in constant communication with the White House in the weeks following the 2020 presidential election, strategizing over how to keep Donald Trump in office despite his incontrovertible loss. "Do not concede," she texted to Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff, on 6th of November, the day before the major news networks called the election for Joe Biden. "It takes time for the army who is gathering for his back. To date, Donald Trump has not conceded." In dozens of messages with Mark Meadows over several weeks, Ginny Thomas raged over baseless allegations of voter fraud and shared unhinged conspiracy theories, including one that the Biden crime family was in the process of being arrested and sent to Guantanamo Bay for ballot fraud. "Help this great president stand firm, Mark," Ginny Thomas wrote at one point. "The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist in U.S. history." Ginny Thomas had already acknowledged some involvement in the fight over the 2020 election count, recently confirming that she attended the 6th of January Stop the Steal rally in Washington. But she said she went home before Donald Trump spoke to the crowd and before a mob of hundreds stormed the Capitol in a violent attempt to block the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. The text revealed that her efforts to subvert the election were far more serious than we knew. Now recall that in January, the Supreme Court rejected Donald Trump's request to block the release of White House records relating to the 6th of January Capitol attack. Mark Meadows had submitted a brief in the case supporting Donald Trump. The court's ruling came as an unsigned order with only one noted dissent, that of Justice Thomas. Perhaps Justice Clarence Thomas was not aware of his wife's text message campaign to Mark Meadows at the time, but it sure makes you wonder, doesn't it? And that's precisely the problem. We shouldn't have to wonder. The Supreme Court is the most powerful judicial body in the country. And yet, as Alexander Hamilton reminded us, it has neither the sword nor the purse as a means to enforce its rulings. It depends instead on the American people's acceptance of its legitimacy, which is why the justices must make every possible effort to appear fair, unbiased, and beyond reproach. That may seem naive, particularly in the face of the crippling assaults on the court that Mitch McConnell and his Senate Republicans have carried out over the past 6 years in order to secure a right-wing supermajority that often resembles the judicial policy arm of the Republican Party. Starting with their theft of a vacancy that was President Barack Obama's to fill, and continuing through the last-second confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, while millions of American voters were already in the process of casting Donald Trump out of office. And yet, the public's demand for basic fairness and judicial neutrality is not only proper, but critical to the Supreme Court's integrity, as the justices, whoever nominated them, are well aware of. Partly in response to the court's tanking public approval ratings, several of them have grown increasingly outspoken in defense of their independence, though not all of them. The most obvious way for justices to demonstrate that independence in practice, of course, is to recuse themselves from any case in which their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. It does not matter whether there is, in fact, a conflict of interest. The mere appearance of bias or conflict should be enough to compel Justice Clarence Thomas or any other member of the Supreme Court to step aside. Many of them have over the years, out of respect for the court as an institution and for the public's faith in their probity. Just this week, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson vowed that, if confirmed, she would recuse herself from an upcoming case challenging Harvard's affirmative action policies because of her multiple personal and professional connections to Harvard University. Legal ethics experts are not even in agreement that her recusal would be necessary, but Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is right to err on the side of caution. Justice Clarence Thomas has paid lip service to this ideal. I think the media makes it sound as though you are just always going right to your personal preference, he said in a speech last year. That's a problem. You're going to jeopardize any faith in the legal institutions. Bench memo to the justice. You know what jeopardizes public faith in legal institutions? Refusing to recuse yourself from numerous high-profile cases in which your wife has been personally and sometimes financially entangled, as the New Yorker reported back in January. Especially when you have emphasized that you and she are melded into one being, or when you have, as the Times magazine reported last month, appeared together with her for years at highly political events hosted by advocates hoping to sway the court. Ginny Thomas's efforts and her husband's refusal to respond appropriately have been haunting the court for years, but this latest conflagration shouldn't be a close call. The texts are the narrowest way of looking at this, Stephen Gillers, at New York University law professor and one of the nation's foremost legal ethics experts, told me. She signed up for Stop the Steal. She was part of the team, and that team had an interest in how the court would rule. That's all I need to know. He said he has over the years resisted calling for Justice Clarence Thomas's recusal based on his wife's actions, but they've really abused that tolerance. Yes, married people can lead independent professional lives, and it is not a justice's responsibility to police the actions of his or her spouse. But the brazenness with which the Thomases have flouted the most reasonable expectations of judicial rectitude is without precedent. From the Affordable Care Act to the Trump administration's Muslim ban to the 2020 election challengers, Ginny Thomas has repeatedly embroiled herself in big-ticket legal issues and with litigants who have wound up before her husband's court. All the while, he has looked the other way, refusing to recuse himself from any of these cases. For someone whose job is about judging, Justice Clarence Thomas has, in this context at least, demonstrated abominably poor judgment. If Justice Clarence Thomas were sitting on any other federal court in the country, he would likely have been required by the Code of Judicial Ethics to recuse himself many times over. But the code does not apply to Supreme Court justices, creating a situation in which the highest court in the land is also the most unaccountable. This is not tolerable. For years, Congress has tried in vain to extend the ethics code to the Supreme Court. For the sake of fundamental fairness and consistency, the code must apply to all federal judges. It would, at the very least, force the hand of those like Justice Clarence Thomas, who seem unmoved by any higher sense of duty to the institution or to the American people, who have agreed to abide by its rulings. The court is in deep trouble these days, pervaded by what Justice Sonia Sotomayor recently called the stench of partisanship, a stench arising in no small part from the Thomas's behaviour. It is hard to imagine that the other Supreme Court justices, regardless of their personal politics, aren't bothered. No one should have to choose between their devotion to their spouse and their duty to the nation. But Justice Clarence Thomas has shown himself unwilling or unable to protect what remains of the Supreme Court's reputation from the appearance of extreme bias he and his wife have created. He would do the country a service by stepping down and making room for someone who won't have that problem.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's time to listen to a short speech by Hujjat al-Islam Dr. Shomali. He's going to talk about the analysis of Ziyara Ali Yassin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, we have tawfiq to continue our reflections on Ziyarat Ali Yassin. We talked about the significance of offering our salam and also why we repeat these salams. And every salam is coming along with some descriptions of Imam alayhi salam. Then we have few more salams, and because every condition of Imam is significant, every condition of Imam can be an example for us, and also because we love him, so we think of him in different conditions. So we have these different types of salams. As-salamu alayka hina taqoom. When you stand up, either for salat or for anything, when you stand up. As-salamu alayka hina taqood. Peace be upon you when you sit down. So whether you are standing up or you are sitting down, peace be upon you. But there can be another meaning. Maybe this qiyam and qu'ud is not physical qiyam and qu'ud. Maybe it is uprising or not uprising. Because, for example, Rasulullah said, Al-Hasan wal-Husayn imaman qama aw qa'da. Hassan and Hussein are imams. Whether they do qiyam, they uprise or not, they are imam. Imam Hassan is going to have peace treaty, ceasefire with Muawiyah. Imam Hussein, for some time, is going to have for 10 years, in the time of Muawiyah, would continue with the same policy Then Yazid comes and forces Imam to do bayah, etc. As you know, he would do qiyam. So both are ma'soom, both are Imam. They make different decisions based on the interest of Ummah, based on the situation. But they are Imam. So qiyam and qu'ud here can be physical, because other parts, for example, says, you know, when the, you go for, to ruku or suju, etc. But it can also be whether you are doing qiyam in the time of zuhur or you are not doing qiyam right now. Qu'ud sometimes means this. In the Quran, we have, you know, this ayah that in the time of Prophet Musa, ala nabina wa alihi wa salam, some of his people, they told him, اذهب أنت وربك فقاتلا إنها هنا قاعدون. You and your Lord go and fight those people who were, you know, there. We are sitting here. إنها هنا قاعدون. We are sitting. What does it mean we are sitting? It means we are not doing qiyam. We are not doing anything. You win the battle, and then we come and take part in the celebration. Some people are always happy to take part in celebration. Some people are worse than that. Even if there is a victory, they make still, unfortunately, mockery, they question, they blame. But some people are better. They take part in the celebrations. But we need people who make victories so that we celebrate. Otherwise, how we are going to celebrate? If there are no people who sacrifice, how can we celebrate? Any achievement, any success needs people who are happy to sacrifice. So they said, "Inna hahuna qa'idun." Anyway, assalamu alayka hina taqum. Assalamu alayka hina taqud. Peace be upon you when you stand up or when you uprise. Peace be upon you when you sit down or when you not, you decide not to uprise. You wait. Assalamu alayka hina taqra'u wa tubayyin. Peace be upon you when you read or recite and explain. It seems that it's about recitation of the Quran and then explaining it for people. You know, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was doing tilawatul ayat, yatlu alayhim ayatik, but also he was doing tabyin, litubayyana linnas ma nuzzila ilayhim. So the first teacher, the first interpreter of the Quran was Rasulullah. Quran is a book that needs a teacher as well. Although it's a book of guidance and explains everything, but Allah has provided us with a teacher so that we can understand it properly, and we can see in this teacher not only good interpretation in words, but we can see him exemplification of the Quranic teaching. Kana khuluquhu al-Quran. Imam also continues the same tasks. There is no revelation. Revelation finished by demise of the Prophet. But we need again teacher. This is why Rasulullah said Saqalain. We need Saqalain. Imam reads the Quran and explains the Quran. This is for the time of Zuhur, but maybe right now also for people who have the tawfiq to be with him. Because we believe that there are people who are with him right now. So they benefit from that. But in the time of Zuhur, inshallah, humanity would benefit from that. There is a beautiful poem in Farsi. I try to remember. It says, چه خوش است که صوت قرآن ز تو دل ربا شنیدن به رخت نظار کردن ز تو نکته ها شنیدن. It seems this poem is perfectly said for this sentence. چه خوش است که صوت قرآن ز تو دل ربا شنیده. How amazing it would be to listen to your beautiful recitation and with your beautiful also face. Someone who is beautiful and recites Quran beautifully. Dilruba means beloved. Someone who is so nice that can win the hearts. به رخت نظاره کردن. Look at your face. ز تو نکته ها شنیدن. And then listen to the points that you are making. Inshallah Allah gives us this tawfiq to listen to tafsir of Quran and tilawat Quran of Imam Zaman, inshallah. As-salamu alayka hina tusalli wa taqnut. Peace be upon you when you say your salat, your prayer. Tusalli, of course, can mean to send salawat, but can, like inna Allah wa malakatu yusalluna ala nabi. But tusalli can also mean to say salat, to say prayer. Wa taqnut can mean when you are making qunut, dua in qunut. So when you are praying, saying your prayer, and in particular, when you are in your qunut, raising your hands to the sky and praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And inshallah, we are among the people that Imam is praying for them to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. In fact, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 was rooted in the Constitutional Revolution of Iran, which began in 1905 and led to the establishment of parliament in Iran. This is at a time, though, Iran is grappling with some economic and social problems in sight and has many challenges ahead. Iran's revolution came about with upheaval in 1979. Going on to 40, the country witnessed demonstrations before its latest anniversary. In the heart of Imam Khomeini's way of thinking, ethics had a special place, and in fact, all areas of knowledge revolve around this pivot.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that if one wants to serve Islam, he should not expect all others to accept him. Now, it's a strange thing that in this speech that if you want to serve Islam, you should not expect everyone to accept you. Why? Because people are doing the things with different goals. Some might have some personal goals, which contradicts the Islamic teachings. Some might have the social or the society, we can say, goals, and it also contradicts with the Islamic teaching. Some might follow the goals that are in line with their culture, with the deeds that generally they do, the things that they perform. So it is not necessary to be in line with the Islam. Therefore, if someone wants to serve Islam, then he should not expect everyone to be following him and accepting him. He should do his own work. It is his deeds that will prove others that the things which he is doing is the right thing. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
صلي على طه النبي
We also have this in the Quran in chapter 16, verse number 112, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِنَ الصَّالِحَاتِ وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ. And whoever performs the good deeds and he is the mu'min, while he is the believer, فَلَا يَخَافُ ظُلْمًا. So he should not be feeling fear of the injustice, of the dhulm and the deprivation. He has to do what he is supposed to do. It is his deeds that will finally tell people, show people the results that he is gaining from all those things. Therefore, it is necessary for a mu'min that if he wants to serve Islam, if he wants his deeds and actions to be in line with Islam, then he should do what is right. He should not care about the other people if they are not following the right path. It is his duty. Maybe in a society we see others doing something else, but I need to do what I'm supposed to do, what Islam is expecting from me, what Allah expects from me, inshallah. And if we can do so, then we will be the victorious, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump and his two eldest children continued their fight to overturn a decision requiring the former president to answer questions under oath as part of an investigation into his business practices, filing fresh paperwork on Monday, 21st of March, that accused a New York judge of abusing his discretion in issuing the decision. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Trump Files Appeal Against Manhattan Judge in Latest Bid to Overturn Subpoena. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and his two eldest children continued their fight to overturn a decision requiring the former president to answer questions under oath as part of an investigation into his business practices, filing fresh paperwork on Monday, 21st of March, that accused a New York judge of abusing his discretion in issuing the decision. In papers filed in a state appeals court on Monday, 21st of March, lawyers for the former president said that Manhattan judge Arthur Engoron failed to properly weigh constitutional and ethical concerns that they'd raised about the investigation brought by the New York Attorney General Letitia James. Lawyers for Donald Trump and his two eldest children, Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr., want the appellate division of the state's trial court to overturn Judge Engoron's ruling, which came on 17th of February, and invalidate Letitia James's subpoenas seeking their testimony. They detailed their arguments in a 72-page joint brief on Monday, rehashing prior claims that Letitia James, a Democrat, had a political vendetta against Donald Trump, a Republican, and that forcing the Trumps to testify would violate their constitutional rights, because answers could be used against them in a parallel criminal investigation. The Trumps' lawyers contend that Judge Engoron was wrong to limit the scope of the two-hour hearing prior to his ruling, and that he didn't have all of the information necessary to make a proper ruling.
The lawyer said Judge Ngoron denied their request for hearings, exploring the nature of coordination between Letitia James's office and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which is running the criminal investigation, and whether Letitia James was engaging in selective prosecution. Letitia James issued a statement in response to the Trumps' court filing on Monday. Donald J. Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump were ordered by a judge to comply with our investigation into Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization's financial dealings, Letitia James said. Despite continuous efforts to impede this investigation, no one can stop our pursuit of justice, no matter how powerful they are. We will continue to follow the facts without fear and without favor. The Trumps and the New York Attorney General's office have agreed to pause enforcement of the subpoenas during the appeals process. Court papers indicated the appellate court will probably hear arguments in May or June of this year. Letitia James has said her investigation has uncovered evidence of Trump's company, the Trump Organization, used fraudulent or misleading valuations of assets like golf courses and skyscrapers to get loans and tax benefits. If Manhattan Judge Arthur Ngoron's ruling is upheld, it could force Donald Trump into a tough decision about whether to answer questions or stay silent, citing his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, something he's criticized others for doing in the past. Meanwhile, former U.S. President Donald Trump has reached an agreement with the New York Attorney General's office that will temporarily spare him from having to answer questions under oath as part of an investigation into his business, as the former president's appeal process in the case continues. In February, a New York judge ordered that Trump and his two eldest children, Donald Jr. and Ivanka, must appear for a deposition as part of New York State's civil investigation into Trump Organization's business practices, including allegations of family company fraudulently inflated the value of its assets. Donald Trump has since appealed that ruling, a move that will probably delay the battle over his testimony by months. Under the new agreement between Trump and the Attorney General's office, detailed in court papers on Thursday, Trump and his two children must sit for depositions within 2 weeks of a ruling from the appeals court, if it upholds the lower court decision requiring their testimony. Lawyers for the Trumps and the Attorney General's office also agreed to an accelerated briefing schedule to speed up the appeals process, which court papers say is due by 31st of March. Lawyers for Trump and Ivanka and Donald Jr. filed papers on Monday with the Appellate Division of the state's trial court, seeking to overturn the Manhattan Judge Arthur Ngoron's 17th of February ruling that they testify. They argue that ordering the Trumps to testify violates their constitutional rights because answers they give in the civil investigation by the Attorney General Letitia James could be used against them in a parallel criminal investigation. Under the agreement reached on Thursday, Donald Trump and his two children are temporarily spared from having to answer questions under oath.